Well, as Emily said earlier, this is the season of Advent. It begins today. This is the first Sunday of Advent, and we're kicking off a new series, and I wanted to ask you a question at the beginning, and the question is simple. How many of you are interested in genealogy? Okay, handful of us. All right, and how many of you have ever looked at your family tree? Like, you've actually done research, not just like your parents and your siblings and your cousins, but you've gone back a number of generations to see what your family tree is like. It's an interesting exercise because you go back and you can ask the question, like, what were the people like that I came from, that my family today came from? When did they first come to America? What were their lives like? Were there any famous people in my family tree? There's somebody famous in my family tree. I didn't do a lot of research, but my dad did. He was into this, and so he put it all together. And so I was looking over it one day a few years ago and looking at all the names who went back. His family is from Mississippi, so his side of the family sort of goes back to Mississippi in the deep south. I saw someone named Jefferson Davis. Does anyone know who Jefferson Davis is? He was the president of the Confederacy. And so I dug a little deeper and to ask about this, and comes to find out the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, is from Mississippi, and everyone loved him, and so they all named their children after him. So he wasn't actually in my family. It was just somebody named after him. But I did find this out. I found out that one of my ancestors, living in Mississippi at that time, owned a huge plantation on the Mississippi River and had hundreds of slaves working at the plantation. And you find out something like that, and that's not really a part of your history that you're proud of. You know, we realize now how horrible that was, And I thought, you know, we probably all have people like that in our background. People that are a part of our background, a part of our family tree, that maybe lived lives or made choices or did things that we wouldn't be proud of, that would be like skeletons in our closet. Things that we wouldn't, I mean, I wouldn't walk up to you and say, hey, guess what? My ancestors owned a bunch of slaves. You know, I would never share that part of my family or where I came from with you. I would elevate the parts that I'm proud of, right? I mean, I would look for, and you would probably look for, are there famous people in my family? Were the people that were very successful? Was there anybody that invented anything? Were there any actual presidents in my family? Those kinds of things. We would never bring out the bad parts of our family tree. Now, here's what's interesting, is the New Testament begins with the family tree of Jesus. That Matthew, when he sat down to write his history or his biography, his story of who Jesus was, he's one of the four authors of one of the Gospels, and he writes down the story to tell us what Jesus is all about, what his life was like, why he came. When he sits down to write that, he decides at the very beginning of his story, he's going to start with Jesus's family tree, Jesus's genealogy. And I want to take a minute to actually look at it tonight. So I want you to grab a Bible. There's some Bibles in the seats sort of in front of you. Try to find one of those, like a real Bible, not a phone Bible. Those aren't real Bibles. Right? Right, old people? Come on now. So get a real Bible and turn to Matthew chapter 1. If you're sort of new to the Bible, it's page 675 in these black Bibles that we have. And we're going to take a look at the very beginning. Actually, let me turn the lights back up a little bit. Yes, we're old. There we go. How about that? We're going to take a look at it. And remember, this is how Matthew starts his story or his history of Jesus. It says this: this is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of... And I'm just going to stop right there. And we're not going to read all of the names. But I want you to do this. I want you to actually take a look at this genealogy, this family tree, and just skim over. Just kind of glance at it. What do you notice? Anything stick out to you? It's a whole bunch of names. Maybe Maybe you're new to church. Maybe you're coming back to church. Maybe you've read the Bible a lot before, but this is one of those sections that we always skip over, right? Or maybe as you glance at some of these names, you think, I'm not really a religious person. I don't recognize. I mean, I saw Abraham in the beginning. I know that name, but that's about it. I don't recognize many of these names at all. Now, we're not going to go through every single name, but I think there's a few interesting things about this family tree, this genealogy, this list that Matthew gives us. The first thing that's interesting is that it's traced through Joseph's line. So essentially what Matthew is doing is he's tracing back the generations backwards from Joseph's line. And he gives us the male descendants that come before Joseph. And in essence, one of the things that Matthew is trying to do, and if you read forward in his gospel, and we're actually going to do that in a few months during the season of Lent, we're going to read the whole gospel of Matthew together. So this is just a foreshadowing looking forward. But in the gospel of Matthew, essentially one of the things Matthew is trying to do is establish to his audience and to his readers that Jesus is the long-awaited king of Israel. That Israel has been waiting for a king to come back and take the throne and lead the people of Israel, and Jesus is the one. And so one of the reasons that he gives us this genealogical list at the beginning is to show us Jesus' descendancy, or Jesus' lineage, traced back to the royal line of David and the royal kings in the monarchy of Israel and Judah. And so if you were to skim back through those names, you would see a bunch of the kings that are listed from the Old Testament. There's David, and there's Solomon, and there's Jehoshaphat, and there's Hezekiah, and there's all these kings, if you've read part of the Old Testament and remember a lot of the stories about the Old Testament. And part of that serves Matthew's purpose. He's tracing the male descendants, and this is what they often did in Old Testament and ancient Near Eastern records, tracing the male descendants to show us that Jesus comes from this royal lineage. But here's the second thing that's interesting about this list, is you notice it's very orderly. It's broken up into three different sections. And there's actually, the first section has 14 different names, and then the second section has 14 different names, and then the third section has 14 different names. And at the very end, at verse 17, Matthew actually says, so there were 14 generations from Abraham to David, and 14 generations from David to the time of the exile, which is really important in Israel's history, and then 14 generations from the exile to Jesus. Now, what's interesting is there aren't exactly 14 generations. Matthew's just constructing this list for us, and he gives it a lot of order, and he gives it a lot of symmetry, because that's just how he thinks, and that's what he wants to do. And he skips a number of generations and a number of names that he could have included. In fact, we could go back to the Old Testament, and he's not trying to pull one over on us, and he's not being dishonest, because he knows any of us could go back to the other records and see, well, that wasn't actually the father of so-and-so, that was the grandfather of so-and-so. You skipped a generation there, Matthew. But he does that because he likes to give order, and he likes to give symmetry, and he wants to just highlight the names and the people and the stories that he thinks are most important to establishing who Jesus is and why Jesus came. So that's another interesting thing. But there's a third thing that I think is the most interesting at all about this entire list. Did you notice that there are five women included in this list? Five women included. Which is interesting on one hand, because he doesn't even need to include women. That's not his purpose. He's trying to show the lineage of Jesus through the royal line of David and the royal line of kings. So he doesn't need to include women. In fact, including women doesn't serve his purposes in any way or fashion at all. So why does he include five women? And why these five women? Because these five women are actually very interesting stories. In verse 3, he mentions Tamar, whose story is quite scandalous, and we're going to actually look at it a little bit tonight. In verse 5, he mentions a woman named Rahab. She's not even an Israelite. So she's not a part of the chosen people, and she actually does something that's a bit scandalous in her day as well. Verse 5, he also mentions a woman named Ruth. She is a poor foreign immigrant, the equivalent of an undocumented day laborer in our culture today. That's Ruth, and she's right there in this lineage. Verse 6, he mentions Uriah's wife. We know her as Bathsheba. And if you remember, there's a quite scandalous story about David and Bathsheba. Matthew doesn't even give her name here. She's just Uriah's wife. But he includes her in the lineage as well. And of course, in verse 16, he includes Mary. Mary, who is a teenager, who gets pregnant and has a child out of wedlock. Something that would have been quite scandalous in that traditional culture. So it begs the question for us to ask, why does Matthew include these women in the family tree of Jesus? I mean, if he's pointing forward and he's giving us this family tree in order to establish who Jesus is and why Jesus came and what Jesus is going to be about, then why does he include these five women? Well, that's what we're going to explore for the next 5 weeks. We're going to look at each of their stories. And I think you'll be surprised to learn some new things that maybe you didn't know about. And I think you'll also be surprised to see how much of your own story or your own life is reflected in the lives of these five women. So tonight, I briefly want to tell you the story of Tamar, the first woman who's listed. And Tamar is probably the most difficult story out of all five. It's the most complex, the most challenging, the most strange, and probably the most unknown. My hunch is that most of you don't know Tamar's story, or if at some point you did a sort of read through the Bible in a year, you skimmed through it and you thought, that's weird, and you just kept moving, and you don't remember. You don't really remember, because there's a bunch of those, and you just kind of put all the weird stories in the weird Bible story category in your mind, and you move on, right? Well, this is one of those, and we're going to look at it tonight. It's found in Genesis chapter 38. Now, let me tell you, here's sort of the setting. You remember at the very beginning of Matthew's genealogy, it all starts with a guy named Abraham. And God makes a promise to Abraham. And he promises Abraham that I'm going to bless the entire world, all the families and all the peoples of the earth through what, Abraham? Through your descendants. Your family tree. It's going to be through your lineage, through the people and the families that come from you. I'm going to bless all the earth. I'm going to bring my salvation and my redemption to all the peoples on the earth through your descendants. So he makes this promise to Abraham. Abraham has a son named Isaac. Matthew tells us that. Isaac has a son named Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons. And his 12 sons become the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel. And one of those sons is named Judah. And Judah has a very dysfunctional family. Now let me tell you briefly about Judah's family, and I want to actually put them, oh, they're on the screen. Awesome. Judah has three sons. And his three sons are named Er, Onan, and Shelah. Er's the oldest, Onan's the second, Shelah is the youngest son. Er takes a wife, and her name is Tamar. But when Er is very young, the writer of Genesis, and I'm going to skip some parts of Genesis. It's a long story, so I'm just going to summarize some parts and then pick out a few verses to read for you along the way. But the writer of Genesis tells us that Er is wicked and he dies at a young age. And so it was custom in that culture that if there were many brothers and one of the brothers died and left a widow who was childless and did not have any sons or daughters to follow them, that it was a custom or an obligation or a duty for the next brother in line to take this widow as his own wife. And so look at what happens starting in Genesis 38, verse 8. It says this: Then Judah said to Onan, "Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the child would not be his. So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. Yes, this is in the Bible. You're like, whoa, didn't know this kind of juicy stuff was in there. Like, what is going on here? Well, what's going on is essentially Onan is the second brother. He knows it's his duty and his obligation. He doesn't mind sleeping with her. But he's decided, and we don't know why. The writer doesn't tell us why, but he's decided he doesn't want to father a child with her. Now, this is probably because of inheritance laws. Because believe it or not, the inheritance of his older brother would have passed to any children that his older brother's wife would have had. But if Tamar doesn't have any children, then the inheritance will pass to the next brother in line. So it actually benefits Onan financially, if he's selfish, for Tamar not to have a child. And so he sleeps with her, but he makes sure that she's not going to get pregnant. Now, the writer of Genesis goes on to tell us that eventually Onan too is wicked. And maybe this gives us a clue why. And that he eventually dies an early and a young death as well. And so now Er has died, her first husband. Onan, the second brother, he has died as well. And now all that's left is Shelah. But Shelah is young, and Shelah isn't very old. And so her father-in-law, Judah, comes to Tamar, and he essentially makes a promise to her. He says to her, when Shelah grows up, when he gets old enough, I will give her to you to be your husband. And hopefully he will father your children. In fact, look at what it says in verse 11, just to read specifically. So Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up. So Judah recognizes it's sort of his duty as the patriarch to take care of her, to provide for her, to make sure that she's protected and that her family line is preserved. So he says, my first son died, second son. So when my third son grows up and gets older, I will give him to you to be your husband. But in the years that follow, a couple of things happen. First, Shelah grows up. He gets older, and Judah changes his mind. He decides not to give his third son to Tamar. And we don't know why. We don't know if he thinks Tamar is like damaged goods now. We don't know if he thinks there's some curse on her. I mean, my first son died, my second son died. If I give her my third son, is he going to die? Like, maybe he was superstitious and he believed that there was some kind of curse. And maybe in his mind he thought, I don't want to waste my third son on her. But he decides not to do what he said he was going to do and give her his third son. Another thing happens. Judah's own wife dies. And it says that he goes through a period of grief or mourning. And after he goes through this period of grief or mourning, he sets out, because it's the time of year to have his sheep sheared. And so he sets out and he takes his sheep to the place where someone will shear the sheep. It's a place called Timnah. And he begins to set out on this journey to go to Timnah. And as he goes, his daughter-in-law Tamar, who's now left in a very vulnerable place, especially in that culture, without any husband, without any children to take care of her, and she realizes now that Shelah has grown up and Judah has not given Shelah to her, she realizes she is in this vulnerable place and she feels like she has no recourse. And so she has to take matters into her own hands and she's going to make sure that she's taken care of. And so she comes up with a plan. And look at what the plan is. Verse 13. It says, when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside, and he said, come now, let me sleep with you. And now it's getting really scandalous, to say the least. Because here's Tamar. She's put in this situation where she feels like she has no other option. And can you imagine how low you must feel, or how bad it must be, when you think your only option is to hide your face and to dress up like a prostitute and go to the place where your father-in-law is going to come, and you know that he's the type of person who might look for a prostitute and then make an advance on a prostitute? That probably tells you a little bit about Judah's character. But Tamar believes that's her only option. And so she goes and she does this and she waits there. And when he comes along, sure enough, he makes an advance at her. And the story says that he sleeps with her. Now, it goes on, and I'll just summarize a little bit for you, because after he sleeps with her, he thinks she's a prostitute, and so she asks for payment. And he sort of looks at her and has this like, like, I forgot my wallet. Like, how did that happen? He says, but I will give you payment. I promise I'll give you payment. He says, here, let me give you a few things. Here, take my staff. I'm gonna give this to you. And then here's my cord and my seal. See, around his neck, he would have been wearing this cord and this little thing called a pledge or a seal. And in any business transaction during that day, he would take... Whoa. Shouldn't have tried to put that around my neck. In any business transaction, he would take this seal and he would go into a contract and he would place it on the contract. And it was a way to say that I'm pledging myself to keep this contract. I'm pledging myself to make whatever payment is required of me. And so if he entered some sort of contract and he had to pay for a house or for a field or for some sheep or something like that, he would put his seal on it or his pledge. It was called a pledge. And that was a way of saying, this is like my word and I will definitely pay you. And so he gives this to this prostitute. He says, here, take my pledge and the cord and the staff, and you know this will serve as a promise that I will send someone back to eventually pay you. And then he leaves. Now she hurries back home. She changes her clothes real quickly so that nobody knows it was her that had gone and covered her face and dressed up like a prostitute. And then Judah gets home, and a few weeks pass, and he brings a courier in, and he gives some money to a courier and basically sends the courier back to the place. He says, go find that prostitute. She's on the road to Timnah. You remember we were there, and you probably saw her. Go find her and give the payment, and then bring my stuff back. And so the courier goes, and when he returns back to Judah, he says, I went there, and I looked for the prostitute, but she wasn't there. And I asked around, has anyone seen her? We never learned her name, but I have this payment for her from my master, and nobody knew who she was. And so I couldn't give the payment, and so I just returned back. And Judah says, well, that's fine. I mean, we tried, I did what I could, and that's just the way it goes. Weeks go by. Tamar finds out that she's pregnant. Her plan worked. She's going to have a child. Hopefully it'll be a son to carry on the family name. But look at what happens next. Verse 24. About 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution. And as a result, she is now pregnant. And Judah said, bring her out and have her burned to death. Now, at this point, if you're thinking, what a pig. I think we're all thinking that, right? I think everybody reading this story in Israel's later history would have been thinking that. How in the world can this man, I mean, what kind of man, what kind of father is he that he is given the responsibility of taking care of this woman, and her husband died, his first son, her second husband, his second son died. He pledged and promised to give her his third son, and then he went back on that and he didn't do that. And then he went and he slept with her. And this, I mean, anybody remember Jerry Springer? I mean, do you remember? Doesn't this, like, this is the kind of story that would be on Jerry Springer. There would be paternity tests and yelling and shouting. This is that kind of story. And Judah is that kind of guy. And you're thinking, what in the world? And then you find out that she's pregnant and she's been a prostitute. And you're going to try her by the law and say she's the one that's wrong. And she's the one that should be punished and guilty of death. Look at how the story goes next. Verse 25. As Tamar was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. I am pregnant by the man who owns these. And she added, see if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are. I mean, can you imagine the look on his face? Yeah. This is the guy. He owns these. Look familiar? Judah? Next verse tells us, verse 26, Judah recognized them and he said, she is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah. She is more righteous than I. And this isn't a statement about prostitution or her sleeping with her father-in-law or anything like that. This is a statement that Judah is making because he realizes in this moment that she's the one that's been forced into making this choice and making this decision that she didn't want to make, but she was doing the best she could with the situation she had. And he's the one who's been unrighteous. He's the one that didn't keep his pledge to her. He's the one that didn't actually preserve and protect her like a good father should, like a loving father-in-law should. He is the one that if anyone deserves any blame or any guilt or any shame for what has been done, he is the one, but not her. She has been righteous as she can be through this. I'm the one who's been unrighteous. Now, the story of Genesis goes on and tells us that she actually has twin baby boys. It's almost as if God is somehow still blessing her in the midst of such a difficult and horrible and shameful situation. And it's through those two boys that are mentioned in Matthew's genealogy. It's through that line that continues, that comes from Judah and through Tamar, that Matthew eventually tells us Jesus comes into the world. This is his family tree. Which begs us to ask the question, why in the world does the writer of Genesis include a story like this? I mean, this kind of Jerry Springer, crazy, scandalous, dysfunctional family. Why does he include a story like this so that generations later would read this? And then why does Matthew, when he's telling us where Jesus comes from, why does Matthew, when he doesn't have to include any women's names at all, it serves no purpose whatsoever towards what he's trying to do, why would he include her name specifically? What makes Tamar's story so significant that Matthew includes it? Well, I want to give you two reasons tonight, and I hope you'll think about these through this coming Advent season. I think the first reason that Matthew includes Tamar's story, it's because it tells us that it doesn't matter how scandalous, it doesn't matter how dysfunctional, it doesn't matter how screwed up your life or your family is. God still invites you and asks you and welcomes you to be a part of his family tree. And that's comforting, I think, for a lot of us. Because it says that when Jesus, or Matthew at least, is telling us Jesus' family tree, he's telling us that Jesus comes from people who are messed up and broken and make horrible choices and have broken lives. It tells us that Jesus comes into a world to reach and to be there for people who are messed up and broken and have terrible choices and have made horrible lives. These are the kind of people that Matthew is later going to tell us Jesus hangs out with. And these are the kind of people that Matthew tells us, Jesus says, come, follow me. You're the people that I ask to follow me, to be my followers. And you're the people through which I'm actually going to change the entire world. What kind of people? Tamar kind of people. And I think that's got to be so comforting to a lot of us. Because if you're anything like me, you've probably got some skeletons in your closet. And I don't mean necessarily your family tree. I just mean in your life. I think we've all thought and done things in our past that we regret, things that we're ashamed of, maybe things we're doing right now that we regret or that we're ashamed of, things that we wouldn't want anyone else to know, things that you would never share at the Thanksgiving table, with any, things that you would keep out of all the official histories and family trees that are shared. And maybe even when you come to church here, you look around like I do and you think, man, everyone else looks like their lives are in such good order. And it looks like their marriages are so happy and perfect. And it looks like their kids are so well behaved and perfect. And it looks like everyone else is so successful and they love their jobs and they're always like everything and their pictures are awesome on Instagram. And it just seems like everyone else's lives is so perfect. And maybe you think deep down, man, I don't really fit in here. My life is not, if people knew what was going on. Or maybe even when you think about God, you feel that way. I don't live up to what God expects of me. I don't make all the right choices. I haven't done all the things the Bible says I should do. And I just don't even feel like I fit in with this whole religious God thing. I think what's so significant about the story of Tamar is it says, no, if a woman who is taken advantage of and not cared for and feels like she's put in a position where she has to sleep with her own father-in-law, if that kind of situation and that kind of person with that kind of life, and you can imagine the kind of guilt and shame she must have felt in that situation, if God loves her, and if God can somehow redeem her story, and if God can take her story and it fits in to his broader redemptive story for all of humanity, then that means that all of us fit within God's family as well. We too are part of his family tree. So if you're here tonight, if there's anything that makes you feel unworthy, if there's anything that makes you feel like you don't fit, I think the story of Tamar says, no, no, no. You actually fit quite well. Because my family tree, I think Jesus would say, is a family tree of a bunch of misfits. A bunch of people who really don't have everything right in their lives, but just recognize they need my grace. So why does Matthew include her story? I think it's to tell us that we all fit in the story. But I think there's one other reason that's so important, and don't miss this. If we could zoom out, if you could like take the Bible and sit it there and then just zoom out to like 30,000 feet and see what God is doing through the bigger picture of the story, I think the story of Tamar tells us that God is a God who keeps his promises. Because you remember the promise he makes to Abraham? I will bring all of my salvation and all of my blessing and all of my redemption. I will bring humanity back into relationship with me. And guess how it's going to happen? It's going to happen through your line, Abraham. Through your people, through your family tree. And guess what? You can't screw it up. Abraham, you can try. You can make some bad decisions, and Abraham does. Isaac, you can try, and you can make some, and Isaac does. Jacob, you can try, and Jacob does. Judah, you can really try. And believe me, Judah does. But it's almost as if the story of Tamar tells us that there's nothing we can do to stop God from fulfilling his promise. And he can work through the most broken and horrible and difficult of circumstances to bring about the kind of redemption and the kind of story that he's writing in each one of our lives. And so, during this Advent season, may you remember that whatever you might be ashamed of, whatever regrets you have in your life, whatever skeletons you feel like you have in your closet, may you remember that you are a part of Jesus's family tree, because Jesus's family tree, it's our family tree for those of us who call ourselves followers of him. And may you this Advent season, whatever circumstances you're facing, whatever difficulties or challenges, whatever challenges you have, maybe it's at home, Maybe it's with relationships. Maybe it's with a spouse. Maybe it's with your children. Maybe it's with your parents. Maybe it's in your finances. They're broken. Maybe it's your career. You've made some bad decisions and things aren't going well. Maybe it's in your health. Maybe something feels broken there. But whatever difficult circumstances or challenges you're facing, may you remember that God promises to always be with us in the midst of our trials and our challenges. To walk with us through them. To love us unconditionally. To never leave us or to never forsake us. And may you remember that there's nothing you can do and there's nothing the circumstances can do to you to stop God from keeping those promises. Let me pray. Father God, we are thankful for Tamar and her story. If she was here, we would celebrate her, and we don't know all the details, but we trust that she had some sort of faith in you to believe that somehow you were in the process of redeeming her broken life. And God, may all of us find ourselves in that place where whatever challenges we're facing, we ask you, would you give us the faith to believe you'll stick with us? You'll keep loving us. You'll keep reminding us of why you sent your son for us. And in this Advent season, we will wait and anticipate and expect and hope and believe. This in your name.